justice and that Kingsland Ziegler presiding, your silence is commanded.
All right, please be seated. Good morning, everyone. We are here on our second case, State versus Michael Jean Witkowski, 21AP 2105CR. And we also have Platteville, who stayed. You were so riveted by the last oral argument, you decided to stay. That's great. Wonderful having you here today.
Good for you.
Justice Bradley, Rebecca Bradley, will be meeting with you, and I'd urge you to think of all sorts of really tough questions to ask her, because she likes that.
Thank you, Chief.
Anyway, we also have Justice Crosby, who is appearing by phone today. So she is on the case. She's just appearing by phone. As I understand it, we have 25 minutes, followed by 35 minutes on rebuttal. If you could make your appearances, please.
May it please the court. My name is Kirk O'Bear. I represent the petitioner, Michael Jean Witkowski.
Thank you. All right. Please proceed, Mr. O'Bear.
Thank you. Chief Justice, I would like to start with a summary of some of the important facts that I'm going to tie to my argument. I know that we're not supposed to review all of the facts, and I'm not going to do that, but I would like to start with what I think is important to distinguish in this case, given where we find ourselves right now as it relates to the community caretaker. On September 6th of 2019, shortly before 1 o'clock p.m., an employee at a McDonald's restaurant in Plymouth, Wisconsin, called to report that there was a driver in the drive-thru that had apparently fallen asleep. Dispatch was relayed to that location, and in less than 1 minute, Officer Simon of the Plymouth Police Department arrived. He then had the opportunity for quite some time to observe this vehicle, again, less than a minute after the call had been made, and saw Mr. Witkowski purchase, pay for, and receive his McDonald's food, then proceed naturally, carefully to the edge of the parking lot, executed a right turn, stopped, and then a left turn into traffic, all done safely, appropriately, and under control. The officer then followed Mr. Witkowski for a brief period of time and then did signal him to pull over. Witkowski pulled over right away into the parking lot of a golf course. At that time, Officer Simon approached the vehicle and had a discussion with Mr. Witkowski. He asked for his insurance card.
I just want to interrupt you real quickly about a fact that I wasn't able to find in the record. Were you able to see any place in the record how long Officer Simon followed Mr. Witkowski before he pulled him over?
There is no specific indication in the record. I know that based on the way the testimony came out, it was not very long. I know that. Distance-wise, it was about a quarter mile. So, and here's where we get to the critical point. Officer Simon has this discussion. There's an issue with regard to the insurance card. As many people do, he had an expired one and a current one. First, he handed the officer the expired one, realized that he had not given him the current one, gave him the current one, provided his license, and they had a discussion about what was going on. Mr. Witkowski did say that he had worked a 24-hour shift. Significantly, Officer Simon did not detect any odor of intoxicants, did not detect any slurred speech, and did not detect that at that time Mr. Witkowski was having trouble staying awake or nodding off or any signs of impairment whatsoever. Officer Simon called for backup, which is when Officer Cobalt, also from the Plymouth Police Department, showed up. He's a more experienced officer. They had a discussion about what should be done here. And that discussion lasted approximately 8 minutes. And at the end of that eight-minute time period, during that eight-minute time period, and this is of significance, they ran Mr. Witkowski's driving record. At that time, after the stop had been executed, after there has been no odor of intoxicants or slurred speech observed, they discover that he has three prior convictions on his record. At that point, there's a discussion about what can they do to justify getting him out of the vehicle? And they have a debate about it. And the officer, the more experienced officer, sort of challenges the younger officer, saying, well, what would be your reason? They sit and talk about it, and he said, gee, I'd really like to get a chance to see if I can smell alcohol, right? So the 8 minutes goes by.
Wait,
again, significantly.
Counsel?
Yes.
Is that in the
in the record that the arresting officer, that is the officer that first stopped your client, said to the more senior officer, quote, "I would like to see if I could smell some alcohol"? I didn't see that. I didn't see that in the testimony.
Okay. What happened was, and again, this was part of the record also in the sense that it was part of the squad car recording, but there was discussion that Officer Simon testified to at the, I believe it was the second motion hearing that we had, where they had discussed him seeking advice from the more experienced Officer Cobalt, who had arrived. He was not the arresting officer. Officer Cobalt arrived on scene second. So
I understand that. I heard you say just within the last minute that the first officer said, quote, "I want to see if I can go and smell alcohol." And I just want to make sure, number one, that is what you said, and number two, that is part of the record here.
That specific statement may not be in the motion transcript, but it is. I know that it is part of the recording, having reviewed it myself, which is also part of the record. So, if I may continue, then I think we know the rest of the story. Mr. Wiskowski is asked to exit the vehicle. The officer notices that there's some difficulty getting out, perhaps a minor stumble of some sort. Then the odor of alcohol, then field sobriety tests, and then the arrest. And of course, Mr. Wiskowski ended up having more than his prohibited alcohol concentration, did not do well on his field sobriety test, and that's why we're all here right now.
Counsel, I want to ask about, I'm going to put aside, the reasonable suspicion argument for a minute, which is at least a question about whether it was forfeited since it wasn't raised below by the state, but I want to ask about just the community caretaking, argument here. Where would you draw the line? What's your best argument? So there's an argument that you make that the stop shouldn't have been made at all. There wasn't enough there to do kind of the kind of check there. There's also an argument that even if the stop was permissible, it shouldn't have been extended, i.e. shouldn't be able to ask for, license, registration, do that kind of stuff. Do you have any other place that you would draw a line, or how would you sort of frame what's your best argument for how this court, how you ideally would like this court to decide the case if we agreed with your arguments that this was improper?
Justice Hagedorn, that's an excellent question, and I think that it gets to the fact that it's very hard to draw bright lines in situations that are designed to be dynamic. Officers in the field are supposed to use their judgment and their discretion, and we don't want to have a bright line rule. It'd be nice if we had those, because then it'd be easy to tell if somebody crossed that line. But in this situation, and I know that there's been several cases dealing with the sleepy driver, and this is a great one because it has the sleepy driver involved. I know the state argued, and they're correct, is that something that categorically, subject matter-wise, is appropriate for community caretaker activity? Absolutely. I mean, if someone's sleepy and there's evidence of that, checking all that out is fine. But what's missing, when the court below did the Kramer analysis and went through the three factors, we have to remember that built within the Kramer analysis are such terms as bona fide caretaker, what a reasonable officer would believe under the circumstances, and totality of the circumstances is incorporated in really the third factor. The reason that's important is because, like all considerations when analyzing the reasonableness, if this is bona fide, the totality of the circumstances, the level can rise or fall based upon the development and perception of additional information. And that's why we challenged the stop itself, because in this situation, Officer Simon had numerous points of observation that counterindicated that this individual was sleepy. That's what this all started with, is somebody being sleepy. Now, I know the state argued in their brief that sleepiness is the hallmark of impairment. I'm not sure that if their argument is going to be that any time anybody is suspected of being tired, that bypasses reasonable suspicion and it's automatically a community caretaker thing. I know they're not saying that. But, I think it's a good point in the sense that we should be looking at all the evidence that was available to Officer Simon and the fact that cumulatively, it would not point to somebody that was having difficulty operating their vehicle. The one data point is somebody called in. They're correct. It was a named person. We don't have one of those anonymous issues here. But how quickly the officer responded and then made immediate observations that this person was having no problem whatsoever operating his vehicle. Then, as I pointed out before, no alcohol odor observed, no indicia of impairment. 8 minutes goes by. Wiskowski's not nodding off. He's not asleep. And there's some conjecture here, but I suspect that one of the reasons why the court accepted this case is because we had the Promer decision that the state referenced in their appendix. And interestingly enough, well, it ended up being unpublished. But that was after Coniglia versus Strom was decided. And if we'd had the benefit of Coniglia at that time, and I'm not saying that Coniglia would mandate the community caretaker not apply here, because I think the state's right, and the court in Promer also pointed out that that had to do with the sanctity of the home. And when the United States Supreme Court proclaims that a standalone community caretaker activity cannot replace the Fourth Amendment, they were talking about the home in particular. And that's absent any kind of reasonable suspicion in that type of scenario. Now, this is, when we're dealing with a vehicle, as here, we have a hybrid. We have more than one consideration. And certainly, sleepiness can be sleepiness. It can also be impairment. That's true. That's common sense. And I think that's what was missing in the court below, is that the court really just latched on to the fact that if we're talking about someone who's sleepy, that's automatically good enough.
Counsel, I know that the McDonald's employee was not called as a witness in the trial court. Does the record, though, contain a transcript of the phone call that was made?
No, Your Honor. It does not. It was testified to at the motion hearing simply that someone was reporting that someone had fallen asleep for an unknown period of time. But I think we can glean from the other facts that it was an extremely brief period of time, because the officer, within a minute of that call, is observing this individual, you know, behaving normally, not sleeping.
Can we go back to your response to Justice Hagedorn's question? Because I have the same question, which, and I think Justice Hagedorn's question had to do with what your best argument is as far as drawing lines here. And you said there isn't a bright line, and then you talk about sleepiness and cumulativeness and the U.S. Supreme Court case and Promer. You talked about other cases, but I want to press you a little bit on drawing bright lines, because that's what we're going to have to do. And so much just for the purposes of drawing a bright line, let's say we all agree just for this moment that the stop was okay under a community caretaker analysis. Then we get to this 8 minute time period, and we get to the second time that the officers contact your client. Is it the 8 minutes that is most problematic for you? Is it that they didn't smell alcohol and then they did smell alcohol? Is it that there was no indication of impaired driving? Like, where is the line for you? When did this, if it was a community caretaker, if the stop falls under that analysis, where then did that end?
Yes, Your Honor, and let me address that specifically, and I'm sorry if I didn't get straight to that point, Justice Hagedorn. In my mind, when the officer had, assuming arguendo, that the stop was justified under community caretaker, at that point when the officer has the opportunity to gather further information, which in this case included confirming that this person was not sleepy, did not smell of alcohol, and was not having any trouble operating his vehicle, the encounter should have terminated at that point, because the original purpose of the stop had been completed. Instead, it was extended for an additional 8 minutes in order to, and this is where we see, you know, you've seen the language in other cases where the pivot from community caretaker occurs and it becomes a law enforcement criminal investigation. And there's nothing wrong with that.
Can I just stop you there for just one second? Is it the 8 minutes? Is it because it was 8 minutes? What if it had been 2 minutes? What if it had been 90 seconds? What if it had been 30 seconds?
I think under the circumstances of this particular case, that is ample time where if there had been problems, if somebody being sleepy, it would have occurred. That's my point. So I know we can't say 1 minute's enough or half an hour's too long. There isn't really any way, and I'm sure the court wouldn't want to have a quantification on that. But the fact that under the circumstances, it's very clear at that point that the original purpose of the stop was no longer what was happening.
Do you agree, counsel, that had they gotten him out of the car right away for officer safety, that our case law supports that?
Yes, I do.
So had they stopped him for community caretaker purposes, assuming that we agree that that was okay, and said, hey, we need you to get out of the car, and then he stumbled, or then they smelled the alcohol, which they didn't smell when he was in the car, something like that would have been a different scenario, but because they didn't do that, they couldn't later then go back to him after 8 minutes and get him out of the car.
But we may have some other issues that would have arisen in that scenario, but I think for purposes of our discussion here today, I agree. Our case law supports the idea that officers can ask someone to exit the vehicle for virtually any reason. And oftentimes it's just to explain something, such as, hey, I thought you might have been tired. Seems like you're okay. Be on your way. And they can get somebody out. But that gets more along the lines of what might be an inevitable discovery type situation, which we're really not supposed to do.
But I was just responding. I think that the state had made that point that they could, well, our case law says you can get them out of the car, but that's at the time of the stop, right?
Right. And it didn't happen. So.
Can they ask for the ID just to verify who they're dealing with?
Pardon me?
Identification?
Yes.
Driver's license? Is that okay to ask for?
Yes, always.
And when does that have to be done by?
Well, normally, I think standard practice, of course, is that's the first thing that happens upon initial contact with the driver. Aside from questions like, how are you doing? Where are you going? May I please see your driver's license? Those are status questions. They're not interrogational. It's standard practice to do so. And in this case, when the officer asked for that, there was no difficulty noted in Mr. Wiskowski producing that identification.
Was that done right away?
Yes.
So any time a law enforcement officer interacts with somebody in kind of a wellness situation, they can pull them out of the car and ask for their license and for a period of time?
Well,
is that really what the law is in community caretaker? I mean, it feels to me that, to the extent there is a community caretaker thing, as our cases have talked about, to the extent that's not investigatory, like reasonable suspicion, I'm not sure that any of the reasonable suspicion kind of things that are pretty ordinary police encounters automatically trigger the right to do all the same things to somebody on the road. Maybe they do. I guess I haven't, if you'd like to tell me, concede that that's the case, that's fine. I honestly have not reasoned.
I'm just well aware of the case law that says not much at all is required to have a driver exit the vehicle.
Yeah. I guess I'm aware of that, too, to some extent. I just don't know if that means at any time
and this may be
runs across somebody in a wellness situation that they can, sort of extend the seizure and get license, run registration, get them out of the car. That seems like potentially that's a pretty broader intrusion on the individual.
And this may be very important in this particular case because when we get to that third factor under Kramer, we do look at the degree of intrusion and everything else under the circumstances. And again, this is somewhat undeveloped because Coniglio was very recent. That was our United States Supreme Court addressing the broader issue of community caretaker. I know it's arisen in various courts throughout the country as to what that means, but I think we're pretty well settled here that when we're dealing with vehicles in particular, we're not going to say that Coniglio extinguished community caretaker. And after all, community caretaker is a very important part of what police do.
So I just want to try to be clear in my mind. Can the officer on a community caretaker stop, ask status questions, and ask for a driver's license?
I believe that would be fine, yes. Now, in this case, we have the preliminary question as to whether it really did amount to a bona fide community caretaker stop after the additional observations the officer had made. But again, assuming arguendo that that stop is supported under community caretaker, we have this additional problem of the extension of the stop to essentially conduct a law enforcement investigation. So we've just been through a couple decades of litigation on this issue with canines. canine stops, where somebody is, an officer is extending the time period that they're interacting with somebody, waiting for a canine to arrive so that there can be potentially the development of reasonable suspicion or probable cause. So I also, I know that...
Can I ask you, this is, we're going to have to engage in a reasonable analysis here, right? Whether or not it was reasonable for the officer to ask your client to get out of the car.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So does that hinge at all? Here, my understanding of the record is that the initial officer, Officer Simon, is relatively new at his job, and so he's going back and he's checking with someone who's a little more senior. Yes?
I'm not sure I heard you very well, Your Honor.
Oh, sorry. Can you hear me now?
Yes.
So my understanding of the record is that Officer Simon, who was the first officer, went back to the car, went back to his car, the squad car, to connect with a more senior officer. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Okay. And so when we're thinking about a reasonableness analysis, do we factor in the fact that, you've got a newer police officer who's perhaps trying to be checking with someone more senior, hey, am I doing this right? And that's going to take additional time. Does that matter at all?
I see the point of your question, Your Honor, and I do acknowledge that there shouldn't be anything wrong with an officer taking time for that, because we don't expect law enforcement officers the day they start their job to know everything, and that's not reasonable. But my point in this is that the discussion itself after Officer Cobalt arrived, which was very quickly, took 8 minutes. That's my point. That was after that whole thing started. I just do want to talk very briefly about the significance of State versus Ulch, which was incorporated into our argument and one of the reasons why the petitioner believes that the court below didn't adequately consider the concept of dissipation. And the reason that this is important is because there aren't very many cases that acknowledge that dissipation, which is a concept that we incorporate into an analysis of both reasonable suspicion and probable cause throughout the case law, that when, let's just use probable cause for example, that if an officer receives additional information, that diminishes, dissipates what had originally been a suspicion. Ulch dealt with a community caretaker case and talked about the fact that that is part of the common sense totality of the circumstances test. And it's important that we consider that. Now, Ulch dealt with a different issue in the sense that it was a different type of community caretaker setting. And, of course, it did talk about the Kramer situation.
Counsel, I want to follow, just go back real quickly to the sort of extension of the stop point. You know, it's pretty clear from the video that, you know, that the officer was moving beyond any kind of wellness issue to a concern that there may be some impairment, but more of a hunch. I think he even calls it a hunch, actually.
I'm glad you mentioned that, Judge.
And then, you know, trying to find some way to figure out what's going on. Now, you know, the blending here, okay, maybe he's drunk driving, so that's dangerous, right? Right. I mean, in the real officer world, you're probably thinking of lots of things at once. But so my question to you is, for purposes of our Fourth Amendment analysis, how much should it matter, does it matter, that the officers, at least during that time, we know, turned into some more investigatory purposes? Or are we looking at this more objectively, as we would, for example, in a normal reasonable suspicion case? We don't actually care that much what the officer was thinking. We care what a reasonable officer would think under the circumstances. What's your answer to that?
Well, I agree that the fact that the officer chose to use that word hunch is not determinative, because we're not supposed to look at an officer's subjective determinations. However, when we are talking about when it's making that transition, that pivot, that we all know the word hunch is a bad word when it comes to reasonable suspicion or probable cause. And it has to be more than a hunch. It has to be an articulable, objective analysis utilizing common sense and the totality of the circumstances. So I'm not here to say it. I think it would be unreasonable that just because an officer uses the word hunch that we got to hold him to it and now, you know, aha, you're wrong. Because, again, but I do think that that's exactly how I would characterize what happened here. It was, in fact, a hunch that does not rise to the level of, you know, reasonable suspicion.
Well, I get that. I'm not talking about reasonable suspicion. I'm talking about the community care team.
Community caretaker, right. And I think that what we're struggling with, and again, let's not forget that community caretaker, when we call it the doctrine or the exception, I think Professor Lefebvre prefers doctrine rather than exception. We are talking about bypassing a regular Fourth Amendment analysis, except for the seizure portion, which is the first factor under Kramer. But getting to what happens when we have, how do we measure it? How do we measure it in terms of reasonableness? And that's why I'm saying we have to look at other examples of when we can't quantify those things. But, again, totality of the circumstances is something that applies in virtually all of these scenarios. I can't think of a scenario where it doesn't. And that should apply in community caretaker. It absolutely should. We have to have some standard. Otherwise, it could end up being a stalking horse where it's utilized for law enforcement purposes. I think it's very clear, and that's why we see the language in the seminal community caretaker cases that discuss the fact that this is something that is completely divorced from law enforcement functioning. That doesn't mean that they can't coexist, and there are certainly cases, and I know the state is arguing that they can overlap. They can. But the point is, we have to have some sort of standard that applies. And my argument is that it should be reasonableness, totality of the circumstances, bona fide community caretaker functioning, and we do have to, as we would in all other contexts, incorporate dissipation as well. I do want to make some distinctions about Promer, just because I know that the state did include that. And it's similar only in the sense that there is a call from a person that says there is a sleeping person. That was a caller from a bar at 9:30 p.m. This person could not, I see that my red light's on. May I finish
my
sentence?
Go ahead and finish your sentence or two.
Thank you. He could not keep his eyes open. He was nodding. He had slumped forward. He had slurred speech. He had excuses about what was going on that did not make sense to the officer. And before the contact was initiated, the officer knew that he had priors. Those are all things that in the process of determining that community caretaker warranted a follow-up to see if that person, Promer, was okay to drive, lean in favor of supporting community caretaker. Thank you.
Thank you.
And may it please the court. So the state's position here is that this court can affirm for two reasons, one of which is reasonable suspicion, and one of which, Justice Hagedorn, you were wondering if it's forfeited. I want to assure you that it is not. And the easiest way to do that is by the affirm for any reason doctrine that the respondent can rely on when the result would not change from that reasoning.
Can I just address that right away?
Yeah.
It's not entirely what our statute says. It says a petition for cross review is not necessary to enable an opposing party to defend the Court of Appeals' ultimate result or outcome based on any ground, whether or not that ground was ruled upon by the lower court, as long as the acceptance would not change the result. I don't think we've ever read that to mean you can raise an argument you didn't raise below in order to reach the same outcome. I think what we have said is that if you raise it below and the court does not address that in its opinion or on appeal, you still have the opportunity to continue to argue that here. So I think it'd be a pretty dramatic expansion of allowing parties, if we agreed with your argument, to raise brand new arguments they did not raise below at all, simply because they could win under them if they had raised them potentially, even assuming you have an argument there.
I understand your point. I don't think it would be a dramatic expansion. The Court of Appeals is already doing this, and we've seen it the most in the post-Caniglia v. Strom cases, one of which was published, State v. Ware. It was not argued by the parties. It was argued under the community caretaker prior to Caniglia about the entry into a house. And then the Court of Appeals said, well, from these facts, though, we can affirm on the emergency aid exception. So I think the facts are here, and if it's raised now and the result doesn't change, you can reach it. But as the rule says, it didn't require.
I mean, forfeiture, you know, obviously we can address those arguments, and sometimes we do raise arguments, but we also have cared about party presentation and not having the arguments completely shift in higher courts, you know. So, Yeah, I do, you know, at least from my perspective, it's unclear to me how you're in a position to raise that argument here. But I understand your argument.
I do have a second point, though, that the defendant affirmatively raised it. So now
that's true, and that makes this unusual.
Entitled to respond.
I'm not going to lie about that.
I think it would also be a dramatic expansion to say the defense can raise an argument affirmatively, and the respondent is forfeited from responding to it.
So, yeah, understood. Fair point.
On the merits of the reasonable suspicion, I think Brzezinski and Navarette, as explained in our brief, are fully in the state's position. The facts of this case are more favorable than Navarette, mainly because the informant is named and willing to give a statement.
For the reasonable suspicion of what?
Of operating while intoxicated.
So you think that you had the officer, based on reasonable suspicion, not trying to aid the driver, you think it's enough to have someone call in to say someone fell asleep at a drive-thru, and then when the officer arrives and sees them getting their food and driving away, that alone is enough because they gave their name. We don't know what they said specifically, right, but they gave their name.
Well, we know that this employee knocked on the window of the car to wake him up.
Okay, right, they fell asleep, yes.
The position is that these facts, that a driver spontaneously fell asleep at the wheel of a running vehicle in the drive-thru, presumably between ordering and getting the food, at 1 p.m. on a Friday, gives rise to operating while intoxicated because the tip was reliable and because it's such an unusual fact indicative of intoxication.
Okay, let's see. I agree
with
you.
Can we go back?
Oh, go ahead, Justice Grofsky.
Thanks. I was just going to go back to the cases you cite. Was it Navarette and was the other one Brzezinski?
Yes.
Well, in both of those cases, there was evidence of poor driving, right? In Brzezinski, I think the informant called and said that the car had been driving erratically, and then Navarette, that's the one where the driver had actually driven the anonymous caller off the road.
Yes, that's correct.
The cases are distinguishable. You said that this situation is better under that analysis.
Because the informant in both of those cases was anonymous, and that makes it there's a higher standard before a reasonable officer relies on the tip of an anonymous informant. The substance of the tip that gave rise to operating while intoxicated was not about the informant being a fellow driver. It was about the informant observing the suspect's driving behavior, and that suspect's driving behavior giving rise to an inference of operating while intoxicated.
Is it good driving to fall asleep in a drive-through at McDonald's at 1 in the afternoon between ordering and picking up your food?
It's extremely concerning.
Okay, so let's assume that this forms a basis. Either this is a basis, reasonable suspicion, or emergency aid, a.k.a. community caretaker. The basis you're saying, actually, let's talk about reasonable suspicion, is that the person might be intoxicated. So the officer goes over to the car and does not observe any other indicators of intoxication. And, in fact, the video, the officer says he stuck his head in the car to try to smell alcohol and was unsuccessful. He tells that to the other officer once he arrives. So, and he's been given the ID, which, fine, he gives him a expired one first. I don't know how many people have expired ones, but I probably do too. Expired registration, whatever, hands that first, then hands another. So at that point, how is it that this stop can be extended for 8 minutes to then go back to him and tell him to get out of the car?
Well, in reference to what he was fumbling with, he fumbled with the insurance cards, and he gave the card for the wrong car.
Okay.
So it wasn't expired. It was
okay, fine. He gave the card for the wrong car that was in his glove box along with the card for the right car, right?
Right.
Okay. All right. So
for one, we know that – I think it's – I've looked it up before here. What is it? Yeah, State v. Van Beek, taking a driver's license itself is not even necessarily a seizure. It's a factor to look in the totality of the circumstances.
Okay, so how do they get him out of the car? How do they get to come back to him after 8 minutes and get him out of the car?
Well, if it's reasonable suspicion, it's under Pennsylvania v. Mims.
What's the reasonable suspicion?
of operating while intoxicated.
But there's no smell of alcohol. He is not acting intoxicated in any way that's documented, and actually they say that he's not. And there's no evidence of bad driving, and at that point, the basis was to assure that he was okay, although you're saying the basis was intoxicated driving. How do they get to extend the stop? Just to keep looking for facts?
I contend over the course of the stop, the reasonable suspicion of OWI grew.
How?
Because of the fumbling with the insurance card and the discovery that he had three prior OWIs.
So they can spend as many minutes as they want trying to find information to substantiate the stop.
No.
Because that's 8 minutes later they find out that he's got prior OWIs.
No, and what absolutely not. What you're getting at, I think, is the distinction from the two U.S. Supreme Court cases in Caballos and Rodriguez. Caballos was an 8 to 10 minute stop where they could do the dog sniff because that didn't extend the stop beyond a reasonable time. Rodriguez was 30 minutes. They extended it by 20 minutes. That was unreasonable. So if the question is, was this stop unreasonably extended? No, it was inconsistent with the amount of time needed to complete, I think the language is the mission of the stop.
The current state of the law in Wisconsin, has it changed? And I don't know that. I understand that you can be operating under the influence, but it doesn't have to be alcohol that causes that, right?
Correct.
If you don't smell alcohol, but you have highly suspicious behaviors, are you precluded from pursuing any other options of why someone may be driving impaired? Medication?
No. And that
marijuana?
No.
There
can
be a lot of reasons that don't necessarily emit the odor of alcohol.
And yes, and I think my take on the squad cam video is that this officer was dedicated to finding the reason why this driver fell asleep at 1 p.m. on a Friday, regardless of the cause.
In fact, he asked about not only about no medications, right?
You hear the senior officer, no medications? No, he says he just got off a 24-hour shift. He was asleep in the McDonald's. He did something weird with the insurance card.
You know, a reasonable suspicion is, of course, in the eye of the beholder, but as was pointed out, we have to take it from the position of a reasonable officer. From one who has operated a good part of my life with sleep deprivation, as I live in Wausau, and I travel from Madison to Wausau, and there's that rest stop about 4 minutes beyond Westfield. And I would often pull over at that rest stop and sometimes pull over on the side of the road and sleep. And so I have in my mind sleep enough, especially at 1 o'clock in the afternoon, might be reason for community caretaker, but not a reasonable suspicion in and of itself for operating while intoxicated. And so that's my sense, respond to that, and then throw into your response the dissipation argument.
My response to the first part is that I think, respectfully, you're improperly privileging the inferences of innocence that the officer is not required to rule out in the reasonable suspicion inquiry. I agree. There could be innocent reasons that he fell asleep, and the officer himself considered those. Mm-hmm. But when we're looking at the objective, reasonable officer, we're not obligated to get those effects.
And that's why dissipation then comes
sure.
into it. So if you'd continue, please.
First of all, there was no dissipation from pulling out of the McDonald's parking lot and onto the road. And I think what's key is to properly state what was the concern of the officer, which was not sleepy driver. The state is not here saying the community caretaker stop can be based on the observation of a driver yawning once.
I'm talking
right?
about reasonable suspicion, not community caretaker.
You don't, reasonable suspicion?
Yeah.
Oh, well, fact that he drove out of the car while awake did not change the fact that he could fall asleep again if he already did it once. Dispatch within 1 minute.
What about impaired driving? How does observing nothing wrong with the driving fit into the dissipation of reasonable suspicion because someone was asleep?
I know that it doesn't fit into this case because in Navarette, 5 minutes of driving, entirely lawful, was not enough to dissipate reasonable suspicion. And we don't know the exact time here, but I think it's undisputed it's under 5 minutes.
Does your argument then not work with community caretaker?
No.
We have to accept from you that there was reasonable suspicion that there was impaired driving as a basis for the stop in order to continue. Because if it's community caretaker, you would agree that that was satisfied with the stop before the 8 minutes took place, correct?
I don't understand the question.
If we were to say that the community caretaker was the basis for the stop, you lose, right? Do you have any argument that that wasn't dissipated?
Yes. The driver...
City caretaker.
Yes. He pulls him over because the officer pulled the driver over because the driver spontaneously fell asleep at the wheel of a running vehicle. In that conversation, the officer was never assured that the driver would not fall asleep again.
Okay, but is that the job in community caretaker, to be assured that nothing bad is ever going to happen again? Isn't a community caretaker / emergency aid, the purpose is to see if he's okay? It's not to assure that he's going to be able to drive 20 miles or 50 miles or 2 miles. It's to make sure he's okay. And weren't they satisfied that he was okay?
Well, I want to be clear, the community caretaker is distinct from emergency aid. That's a different exception.
Maybe not. Okay. But we can have that discussion.
That'll be a different case.
Right. Well, it may be a different case. But either way, let's call it community caretaker because we do have case law that talks about that.
The officer's job under the community caretaker exception, especially looking at KDV Dombrowski in light of Caniglia v. Strom, is to ensure the highways are safe for the community, and they can take actions.
You think that's the basis, is to ensure the highways are safe for the community? They can stop anybody to ensure the highways are safe for the community?
Oh, well, no, of course not for any reason. But when they identifiable concern, the unusual act.
All right, so counsel.
Can I hear his answer first, please, Justice
Perkins?
Can I have a follow-up? Because I'm really, this seems super broad. So tell me where this gets cut off, because, they could, and under that scenario, they could arrest him. They're afraid he's going to fall asleep again. Community caretaker, let's make sure the highways are safe, right? Where does that end?
You would need probable cause of a crime to arrest, and we're not arguing that they have that.
Okay. Where does your community caretaker argument end? You want us to say the community caretaker could extend to just protecting the highways from all the people.
I'm saying that Caniglia v. Strom says it only extends to the highways. That Caniglia v. Strom was about bringing it back. I shouldn't say
Well, it
only,
doesn't. Caniglia was about it not applying to the home. But
how
does that get to protecting all the highways?
All right. I think there's a really important quote from KDV Dombrowski. This is 413 U.S. at 441. In talking about what the duty is, the court said, quote, in referring to citizen-police interactions on the roads, some such contacts will occur because the officer may believe the operator has violated a criminal statute, but many more will not be of that nature. And in the next sentence, the court uses the term community caretaking for the first time. That is the essence of the job. It's a distinct duty separate from criminal investigation.
And it has no end. It's like if you see it, you can proceed
I don't quite, of course not, it doesn't have no end.
So if you're assured the person's okay, that's what I'm saying. How do we...
Oh, well, if you're sure the person's okay, then there's the basis for the community caretaking stop ends. But the state contends that the officer never learned that the driver was okay in these situations. He learned that he had been awake for 24 hours, that he struggled with the insurance card, and that he had 3 prior OWIs. He became, I just want to see if he can stand and then let him go. Well, he couldn't.
I understand Caniglia addressed community caretaker in the context of entry into the home, but many members of the court, and it was a unanimous opinion, seemed to disavow the idea that community caretaker is a separate doctrine and different rules apply when the police are acting in a community caretaker function, that somehow Fourth Amendment rights are sacrificed to the doctrine. But it seems that the United States Supreme Court is calling into question this court's and other courts' jurisprudence that there's a community caretaker exception, if you will, or a separate analysis under the Fourth Amendment for community caretaking. And the concurrences seem to coalesce around the idea of this isn't a separate doctrine, and if somebody does possibly present with an emergency, then that's an exigent circumstance, and that is the doctrine that the court should apply, not that, oh, somebody such as the defendant here, the petitioner here, that somebody might be having a medical emergency, we better make sure he's okay.
Sure. I understand the reading. I read it a little differently. I read the majority opinion sort of in conclusion is today we bring this doctrine back in line with what we originally said in Katie v. Dombrowski. And then I took the concurrences as saying, because that oral argument, I think there were a lot of, well, what if an elderly lady disappears for 10 days in her home? Can they go in? And so I took the concurrences as saying, you're still allowed to go into someone's home if an elderly lady hasn't been seen for 10 days because of the emergency aid exception. I sort of saw them solving that parade of horribles.
So, counsel, has the United States Supreme Court approved at all the community caretaker justification in cases with a moving motor vehicle? Do you have any examples of that?
Not off the top of my head. I think Katie V. Dombrowski was a parked car, or like in the middle of the road. You know, I don't.
Thank you.
Well, and I just want to follow up on the questions of my colleagues on both sides here. I mean, one of the fascinating things about the series of laws, you have United States Supreme Court, which has used community caretaking in the context of sort of impounding vehicles that have been stuck on the highway, right? And then you have these lower courts that take that, maybe blend a little bit of some of the emergency aid stuff, and almost every court around the country seems to develop over time some version of this community caretaking like we have. Tests vary a little bit, but by and large, you know, sort of the broad thrust of it seems to be, and analytically where it fits in and how our prior case law fits in, you guys haven't briefed all that stuff, but it's certainly a question that some of us are interested in and have looked at in preparation for this. But the broad thrust of a lot of the case law seems to be, you have some like emergency, you know, kind of gravish threat to public safety. Law enforcement, in the context outside of investigatory purposes, can step in and kind of make sure everybody's okay, as long as they do so reasonably. And that is, in fact, a reasonable kind of search and or seizure. So car stuck at the side of the road, somebody needs emergency aid, you know, that sort of thing. This does seem like a pretty expansive view of stopping somebody because you got a call that they fell asleep, particularly if you get behind them and they're driving away. So I in light of some of the concerns that my colleagues have, you know, hinted at in their questions, I question about whether this is broad. You can make an argument under Kramer for lots of things, right, because it's pretty flexible. It's kind of a balancing test, and is it reasonable? Did you do it proportionately? But I look at some of the thrust of that in Coniglia in particular, in the thrust of those separate writings, and have some skepticism about whether the threshold for you stepping in needs to be maybe a little bit higher, a little bit graver of a circumstance than, I hope he's okay because he fell asleep in a drive-thru, which, as Justice Ann Walsh Bradley said, I've been known to be sleep-deprived for much of my life, too, so I can sympathize with that.
Good.
Yeah.
Surely loves company.
Yeah.
But I think that comment really gets at, though, is that what then we're really talking about is the third prong of Kramer. We're measuring the intrusion into the privacy
sure.
versus the public
Some
interest.
Kind of proportionality.
And so perhaps we have a different, I'd say that this is a pretty serious public interest that many people are tired and drive. Many people eat their food while driving, even if they're driving with one hand, and that makes them less accessible as a driver. The state's not saying that justifies community caretaking. It's this really unusual and potentially dangerous, as the circuit court noted, to other drivers, to pedestrians, and to the driver itself that triggered it.
I'm concerned about what I hear is a rather expansive definition of community caretaking from you. I think there it is certainly well advanced, that perhaps there are many definitions or applications. But from you, I heard this rather broad application. Justice Hagedorn just made reference to, you think you want to make sure that everyone is okay. And that has been my kind of generic reference to community caretaking. It's focused on an individual, right, or individuals who may be in harm. And yet you espouse a much broader, that is, community caretaking implicates keeping the highways safe as opposed to focusing on any individual. That's the focus of community caretaking. And, of course, we have Coniglia to deal with, but that aside, and I'm not saying it can be put aside, but I think of intruding into someone's house. Drugs would be a good example. Why? Because we want to keep the under the community caretaker broad definition, we want to keep our communities safe from drugs. So this broad definition, understandably you're doing it in the context of a car, frightens me. Tell me why I should just think, oh, this is just fine.
Well, because of Coniglia, it won't be used to go into the house for drugs, right?
I know,
so not there.
I know that. But it's that kind of broad application. Absent Coniglia, and that was only 2021, a few years ago, who knows, right?
Sure. And but, you know, the Court of Appeals got Ulch right, and I think Ulch was anticipating Coniglia. So I think Wisconsin courts have been doing a good job with it. To answer your question...
What justifies your broad scope?
Yeah, it is, I think, more unique to the context of this stop that the risk of other drivers matters. Some community caretaking stops are indeed the driver has pulled over, their hazards are on, and the officer is justified to stop to get out and check. That doesn't pose an immediate threat to other people, so it's not considered either by the officer or in the ensuing court analysis if a case comes to it. I don't think that precludes the consideration of the community as the community of drivers, since we're talking about a duty on the road, we all share the road, and it's a highly regulated environment.
But the public society also has a strong interest in losing its freedom to come and go as we please without police interference.
Yes.
Unless there is a strong justification for it. And here we had a report of somebody sleeping, not while he was driving, but while he was in the drive-through.
Yes.
And then he safely operated his car.
He successfully made a turn out of the parking lot. We know that. We don't know what would have happened down the road because the officer stopped him timely.
Well, the officer could have followed him too, right?
He could have.
Seen how he was driving. There's nothing that prevents an officer driving behind you and following you, seeing if you're driving safely.
I think the circuit court got it right, though, that he could have done that, but then he risks endangering himself and doesn't actually stop a crash if he spontaneously falls asleep again from happening. That's just observing it happen. We've managed to address all the points I wanted to raise today. I'm happy to take any further questions.
Could you just, as one further follow-up, if you were to be writing an opinion, which we're thinking about, focusing on the community caretaking in particular, how would you frame and just work through very briefly, like in a paragraph, how would you frame like a holding, a summary of why this was a proper application of a community caretaking stop and or continuation of it?
I'd start with Kramer, that completely divorced does not mean that the officer must lack any subjective knowledge of criminal reasons. What we have here is a stop because the officer was concerned that the driver spontaneously fell asleep in a drive-through at the wheel of a running vehicle. He pulled him over to stop to verify that he was safe to continue driving and would not sleep again. In so doing, he considered a variety of reasons why he might have fallen asleep spontaneously, both criminal and non-criminal. And then when the driver was unable to verify to his satisfaction that he could drive safely. He asked him to get out of the car to see if he could stand and walk, and when he couldn't, that became the case we have today.
Most of the cases in language does include this sort of, it has to be totally divorced from investigation, and your summary right there used included a criminal investigation element. How would you reconcile that?
I wouldn't say it was a criminal investigation. It was a consideration that alcohol might have caused him to fall asleep, which happens to be criminal, which I think is exactly like what Kramer was getting at when the officer could have his hand on the gun, but that doesn't mean he was investigating crime. He was just relying on his experience in the environment of a side of the road stop.
Doesn't that in some way implicate good old Welch case? You know, we have, of course, first offense isn't criminal.
I'm sorry?
First offense, drunk driving, is not criminal.
Right.
So, in response to the question, you indicated that there was, you know, inference of criminal activity because of the sleep, and yet first offense not criminal.
Then I guess, no, that would not. Mm-hmm. Correct. Well, thank you very much for your time and your questions, and the state asks that you affirm the order denying suppression. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Chief Justice and your honors, I'd just like to address a couple points that my colleague raised. And I do want to point out that when we are discussing the existence of prior OWIs on somebody's record, now again, this gets much further into the encounter, and our argument is that this is not something that, you know, that it's part of what converts it to that criminal investigation. But in terms of the consideration that is due, we see that come up in cases where an officer knows that due to someone's prior convictions, they have a lesser prohibited alcohol concentration by statute, which is why in those cases the odor of alcohol becomes important. And I just point out, in this case, there was no odor of alcohol. So when we borrow from cases that talk about that being a consideration as to further investigation, it does rely on the odor of alcohol always being connected. Justice A.W. Bradley, I'd like to just expound a little bit on this idea that when we try to pin down what community caretaker means, I agree with you that are you okay is really kind of the best way to word it. But I'd take it a step further to say, do you need my help? I know I'm wearing a uniform, but I'm here as a helper right now. And that's where I think we come up with this, you know, divorced from law enforcement delineation. But counsel is correct that there are often times where it's very difficult in the real world to have that type of bright line, so I don't disagree. But, Justice R. Bradley, I'd like to just indicate that I agree with you that the higher courts and the U.S. Supreme Court appears to be signaling that, at least in my opinion, this has gone too far down the wrong path. And I know that when I had studied over the years this development of what we now call community caretaker, the first thing that popped in my mind is we already have exigent circumstances. That's been a long recognized exception to the warrant requirement. And we have many, many examples of how that would apply. And if this were a true emergency where somebody really needed help in, we want to encourage officers to bypass concerns about the Fourth Amendment, we have exigent circumstances there that already covers that topic. So that's where we get a little confusing in terms of how we're going forward. And I wonder...
Can I ask you a quick question?
Yes,
Your Honor. Do you disagree with the part of the community caretaker framework? And Justice Dallas got into this a little bit with your friend on the other side that talks about protecting the community. How do you respond to that? Because I'm not sure exigent circumstances or other emergency doctrines would necessarily get there. I mean, I think we can all agree that we don't want people driving on the roads under the influence of intoxicants. We don't want them to get into an accident and hurt and kill somebody else. So can you just, will you respond to that?
Yes, Your Honor. I echo what Justice Dallet stated as a concern that if we just the community at large are all people at all times and all places, that's an unworkable way to define the community. If we limit it to the safety of those around us and the risk that they may pose from potential drunk drivers, I understand that. If we're trying to limit it to, I guess, a more immediate community, but it's still so broad that I don't know how this court or any court can give sufficient guidance to the law enforcement community and the courts below. And I think by this court finding that this went too far and this was too broad does give that guidance that is needed as an example of what should not be considered ultimately justifiable by community caretaker. Are there any other questions? Thank you so much.
Thank you. Interesting oral argument. Thank you for coming today and presenting. Questions for you. Nice to see the class here. Justice Rebecca Bradley will be out shortly to meet with you, and the court is adjourned. We will convene at 1:30 in closed conference.